Empire podcast this week, we have a lovely chat with the very well-behaved star of Misbehaviour, Gugu Mbatha-Raw. Plus the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that knows it's said in the past that they should stop releasing movies so we can get caught up. But this is ridiculous. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire podcast, which possibly for the last time for a while is coming to you from the dim, dark, dank, grey pod booth, yes, that is our pod studio, and I'm joined by three hopefully non-infectious colleagues of such lethal cunning. Our geek queen, Helen O'Hara, is here.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank
you. Stockpiled on Supernatural and the Hamilton soundtrack.
I mean, that's all I need.
And water and food and whatnot. I mean, as well.
Those I don't have so much of, but I've got Supernatural and Hamilton. I think that should do it.
Next up, we have Alex Godfrey.
Hi.
How are you, Alex? What are you stockpiling?
I'm ready for the apocalypse.
Yeah, well, I think it's ready for you as well, in fairness.
It's got me a long time ago.
And last but not least, we have James Dyer. We know what you've stocked up on.
I'm thrilled. I'm in my element. I'm basically Negan anyway, so I feel that this is my time to shine.
West Wing and wet wipes, that's basically all you have.
Yeah. Well, I've set up my own little compound where I am a warlord. Barbed wire, you know, usual stuff to keep the walkers
barbed wire. I mean, that's a great movie.
Yeah, I know. Many, many copies of that just for people to watch. It's all pretty good.
You need many copies of the same film.
Yeah, you do. But I'm crossbows. It's all good.
I mean,
good.
James genuinely has been prepared for the zombie apocalypse for years. Yeah. So this actually is not.
Do you have a bunker?
I feel this is just an Eddie bunker.
Don't tell them if you have a bunker, okay? They'll all be trying to get into it.
I bet it's an amazing bunker.
It's all a bit Cloverfield Lane, like.
I bet your bunker's like Patrick Bateman's bunker, if he had one.
He's just got a larger telly.
It's funny because it's true.
Yeah, it's funny because it's true.
Yes, and we're trying to find humour in the current situation well, because as you may know, everything's fucked. Yeah. It's all fucked. Everything's fucked.
What's really funny is I was going through. Like, you know, when studios, distributors, they send out sort of press kits, media drops for all sorts of things. And I was going, I went up into my loft to find the one that got sent out for Contagion, which I still have. I've got a couple of others, these sort of how to survive a viral apocalypse media kits, which I stashed in the loft. I'm like, yes, come on.
Did I have a candle that smelled like Gwyneth Paltrow's Holiest of Holies, or was that just... Is it just something she developed afterwards?
That does absolutely keep the virus away. I know that because I read it on the Goop website.
Allegedly.
We
should point that out.
Oh my God.
We should point that out. Anyway, some gallows humor there for you. But anyway, things are escalating, as you know. In case you're buried under a rock, in which case, stay there.
Yeah.
The coronavirus crisis, for it is that, is getting worse by the second, and it's hitting us where it hurts. A Fast and Furious film on Tom Hanks, pretty much.
It's not okay.
It feels like Hans Gruber in Die Hard. Like, sooner or later, maybe I'll get to someone you do care about. And finally, he got to Tom Hanks,
and we
were like, this is ridiculous. Okay, Corona, now it's on.
Now it's on.
They struck down Tom.
You have
an
made
international
Tom
treasure.
Yes. And Rita Wilson,
Yes.
Both of them. Yes.
Are they together? Are they quarantined together?
Yes.
They are. Yes.
They've been put on an island with a volleyball.
The yes. volleyball picture was fake, to be clear.
Yeah,
but
it was funny.
Was it?
It was funny.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
It was a joke, yeah, but it was pretty good.
Oh, such a shame.
Yeah.
But anyway, yes, in case you haven't been aware of the news, so last week we were discussing the Bond thing being moved back? So Bond 25 moved back. It was meant to open in April.
Yep.
Then it moved back to November to give some breathing space for the corona crisis to be resolved. Then after that, there was Peter Rabbit 2, the second one to hit.
The big one.
But that also has some myxomatosis concerns as well, so you can't double up there, can you?
That's what I said.
It's true.
That was my joke.
That's what I tweeted the other day, Hells. What can you do? You got to be pretty sharp to get me. We're all feeling good, right? We're all feeling good about ourselves.
Super
anyway.
Good.
I'm feeling like Bruce Campbell at the end of Army of Darkness.
Which ending?
The apocalyptic ending. Not fun in a supermarket.
The one where
ending.
He accidentally sleeps until
he
like the end of the
long.
Day. Or the one where it's shop smart, shop S-mart.
The one where he goes shop smart, shop S-mart, but there's no bog rolls left.
Yeah, the deadites have done a run on them.
We're laughing because we didn't. This would be a podcast entirely composed of four people crying in a room. But anyway, it's so then Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson came down with the coronavirus, but they seem to be fine. They're down in Australia, and you know they're getting through it, and they will be okay. Mm. Listen, if they could survive being in volunteers together, they can survive anything.
I like to think of us as like we'll be podcasting through the apocalypse, like the band that played on during the sinking of the Titanic. We'll be rambling
it's
on
not
about
the best
films
analogy.
And everyone dies around us.
This is that's not okay.
You're saying you won't do it, Helen?
I mean, obviously I'm going to remotely pod. I'm just not clearly, I'm not really super good
we
with
have,
dying.
We should say, as a sort of PSA, we have got a system, we can pod remotely, so even from isolation we
can
be in.
Oh yes, people at home
are
so relieved by that. Yeah. Oh, thank
that's
God.
That's what people were worried about.
I can't go to work, you know, we're dying, we haven't got any toilet roll to wipe our asses with, but don't worry, the Empire podcast will still be with us.
Yes, and what's the film news this week? None. What are the movie releases this week?
Yeah.
None.
So, review section now, and it's time to tell you what's out in the multiplexes this week, and it is
nothing.
Oh. They're re-releasing Fast and Furious 4 at a cinema near Rye. Would you like to go see that? 300-mile walk? No? Okay, we're good. Rye's not 300 miles from here, and there is a cinema in Rye.
Is there?
There is, anyway. But I'm confident.
I've been to that cinema. It's in an old church.
It is. It's very nice. Yeah. Very nice cinema.
It's
confident.
Worldly, Alex.
Rye. I'm confident that this will be mitigated soon, you know, that will, you know, there'll be periods of self-isolation, perhaps a national period of self-isolation and
self-flagellation
and slowly but surely the tide will
turn. I agree with you. In fact, it's a funny thing, I had a dream last night. A woman came to me, her name was Mother Abigail, and she asked me if I could go on a journey. It was an interesting one.
First of all,
interesting one.
You would get Randall Flagg.
Randall
and you
Flagg.
Fucking know it.
It's true. It was Vegas was the destination, it can be said. So. Damn it.
You are trash can man. if ever I saw one.
Yeah, I am off to Nebraska.
Yeah,
you're off to
them.
Vegas.
Yeah.
No question.
But then, as we were just about to record this, there came news that A Quiet Place Part 2 has moved back indefinitely. Yeah. And this is a big one because that was meant to come out next week. Mm. And I was due to interview Emily Blunt and John Krasinski on Monday as well. We were meant to see it tomorrow / today if you're listening to this on Friday, March 13th. Unlucky for us because that's not going to happen anymore. And then, of course, Fast 9.
Oh, they really got us where it hurts.
Yeah, they really did. As we were recording our Onward spoiler special, which will be up very, very soon, came the news that it's moved back, but not like Bond, 6 months, but by a whole year to the slot that had previously been held by Fast and Furious 10, which to my knowledge hasn't even started filming yet. So you can maybe see why they would push that back a little bit. So there's lots of talk now that Mulan's going to push back, that, you know, April might be a bit of a wasteland. Cinematically speaking, cinemas might even be closed, might even be a governmental decree to that effect.
Which, as we speak, is not happening. Those kind of public but gatherings are still okay.
Yeah, but it is all right because TVs will still work and the Pilot TV podcast will be there.
Oh, Jesus
Read
Christ.
The room,
every
James.
Show
Jesus
has
Christ.
A drop.
Read the room.
Live
this
from
is
your
my
bunker.
Time.
Read the room.
It's a horrible room to read.
Yeah, it's true.
Your dying words are going to be,
the TV podcast
is available. This is unprecedented. This is huge. And obviously, it's going to affect people seriously. There's going to be a huge economic downturn as well. People are going to have lots of problems. There's going to be deaths on a major scale, of course. And it seems a little bit ridiculous to be sitting here complaining that a movie has moved back by a year. But what do we make of all this? I mean, when's it going to end? Do you think Black Widow surely isn't going to come out on May 1st?
I wouldn't have thought so. It feels like everything will get pushed back, and it makes sense from a purely kind of fiscal point of view. People are either not going to want to go to cinema or fundamentally not be able to go to the cinema. So what's the point in releasing massive?
This isn't about specific
movies.
Films. It's about audiences in
it's
general.
About exactly that. And you're right. It is. This is unprecedented. Like people joke. I joke. You know about like we're living in The Walking Dead and whatnot. Nothing has happened like this in our lifetime. My mum was saying it reminded her of the war. Do you know what I mean? Like, it feels like that, you know, curfews and whatnot. We've not experienced anything quite like this.
This is the weird thing about this is actually the longer this lasts, kind of the better in terms of management. So this is about, you know, you've seen the diagram probably online of the curve of infection. So if we do nothing and if we all keep going as we are, then the curve of infection is very, very steep and rises very, very high all at once and then drops. But that overwhelms the healthcare system in any country you care to name. And
especially
lots
at
of
this
people,
time of year.
And this, especially at this time of year. And lots of people die simply because they can't access healthcare.
Yeah.
Whereas if we slow the rate of infection by taking these measures, we massively prolong the outbreak, but we keep it below the threshold of what the system can cope with, and therefore lives are saved. So actually, this is a best case scenario if this goes on for 6 months, and it's horrific to think so, but it is. And so I'm trying to be, you know, zen about the whole thing, but geez, what a...
I feel terrible for people who are in kind of 0 hours jobs or kind of in working the gig economy, you know, who don't have paid sick leaves in the same way that people on staff do. You know, it's
oh yeah, thank you. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, Helen, you're a freelancer. But you know, it's
bad.
It's bad.
Bad.
Yes, thank you, Alex. It's bad.
It's gonna be, you know, if cinemas are closed, how do they stay open? How do they have enough money to stay open, to reopen whenever this thing is over? As I'm very confident it will be, that there will be, you know, come a time, whether it's the breakthrough with a vaccine quicker or whether just for this period of self-isolation, they've shown in China, I believe, that actually is beginning to work and the tide is beginning to turn, and it can work if we all self-isolate, or, you know, for 2, 3, 4 weeks, then hopefully it'll be okay. But
the strangest thing is just not knowing.
Yeah.
Not knowing what's happening, when it's going to happen, how long it's going to go on for, what you're going to wake up to tomorrow. It does feel like it's 28 days later out there at the moment. So it's surreal.
It's the rage virus.
Well, no, that's just you, James.
Yeah. We couldn't tell if you were infected with it, in fairness.
Patient zero.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a scary time out there. It really, really is. And obviously, we hope that everyone is safe. We hope that everyone listening to this is washing your hands regularly as well. But someone was saying today, like, who's going to be the first big studio to bite the bullet and start releasing their movies on streaming?
I don't know if economically they can with stuff like with these kind of $150, $200 million movies. I don't know if they can just go straight to streaming.
Because you'd need, like, Netflix would have to pay them a fortune to make it worth their while.
Who says Netflix? Like,
well, any of the streaming service. I mean,
even Disney Plus's own. No. Like, I think they would rather delay. And I think that's what's happening. I think they would rather delay. Now, for some of the more medium level movies, the ones that were going to the cinema was always kind of maybe a bit of a, maybe not a massive win situation, but it was going to help them down the line in terms of publicity and so on. Those films might go to streaming, I guess. But it's hard to say right now.
Well, let me ask you a question, guys in this room. Obviously, not the people who are standing outside listening with a glass up against the wall. Are you scared of going to the cinema at the moment? I went last night. I saw Bloodshot. I paid my own money to see Bloodshot.
I mean, the thought of paying my own money to go and see Bloodshot scares me.
But yeah, it was terrifying as I parted with it, but I had to do it because, you know what? I'm a pro.
Did you sit near people?
Yes.
Were there other people watching Bloodshot?
It was just Chris and Vin Diesel.
Yeah, pretty much. On his way to a $560 million opening weekend, as he has boldly and confidently claimed it will do. Maybe because it's the only movie left.
Yeah, that's right.
He has a really good chance of doing it. No, there were people, and someone actually moved sat next to me, you know, because they were sitting in someone else's seat and they had to move next to me. But
I feel okay going to the cinema, I have to say. I've been out and about a little bit, and
we're on the tube, on trains, whatnot. It's much the same thing.
I just don't want to be coughed on.
Yeah,
that's something.
But at any time, really, I don't want to be coughed on. Like
sometimes
that hasn't changed.
Yeah, no, I'm still feeling all right about that. But I think also, you have to figure out how to not just minimize. You have to figure out how to minimize risk, of course, but you also have to figure out how to strike a balance in terms of, you know, keeping yourself sane and keeping yourself healthy and keeping yourself mentally stable and everything else. And and for me anyway, like, cinema is part of my regime as much as running or going to the gym or, you know, eating is it. I have to do it. So yeah, I'm okay.
It's crazy. We have changed our routine a little bit, and we are looking at it. No, nothing official yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if this, honestly, as I said at the beginning, was the last time for a while we're recording it in the studio together. You know, but we are, as James said, we're going to be taking steps to make sure that we can bring
you our podcasts every week, and the spoiler specials, they'll be updated as well, even as they push the movies we would have been doing spoiler specials on back by a fucking year. But we've changed the routine as well. Usually before we do a podcast, we get together and we rub our faces against each other, and that's changed. That has changed. HR said no to that.
As you all want to do.
Yeah, and I've had to put trousers on, which is a podcast first.
Chris, that's not how
Hallelujah.
Anyway, so that's probably all the coronavirus news is fit to print. We, as I say, we hope that everyone is well, and if we hope, you know, if you do get it, that we hope that you recover from it very, very quickly indeed, and keep washing those hands. What we're going to do is we're going to keep talking about movie news. We're going to change things up a little bit this week because we're already on movie news. Let's stay with movie news, and in a sort of rapid, quickfire jump to good news. Harvey Weinstein's in prison for 23 years.
23 years.
He'll probably get coronavirus in there very quickly.
That is a genuine risk, actually.
No, of course.
It's a massive problem in the US, especially because they have prisoners making hand sanitizer, but not allowed to use any when you visit prisons in the US. It's horrific at the moment. Anyway, so I don't want to actually joke about that, but I do want to joke about Harvey Weinstein being in prison, because fuck him! Ha! He may also get more years on top of that, because the case in California is still pending.
Yeah. Realistically, he's not getting out of prison, is he? Like,
not alive.
Given his age and health, it seems like it's a life sentence. So.
Has there ever been a bigger power reversal than this? You know, I mean, he had the world at his feet, right? Mm. He could do anything, say anything, tell anyone what to do, pretty much get anything he wanted, and now he's going to prison. Mm. How does he deal with that? This is not a sympathy, by the way.
No, not at all. In fact, did you see Epstein also? Yeah, well, that's true. Did you see Kate Beckinsale's Instagram post this
week? I did, yes.
Where she talks around that she wasn't sort of sexually assaulted by Weinstein, but she was sort of verbally assaulted and threatened at his home.
Absolutely.
After not wanting to do the Serendipity premiere because it came after 9/11.
She wore the wrong outfit.
Yeah, but that's it. She didn't want to do it. And he said her face, she looked dour and she wasn't looking sexy enough. And the language he used, it's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, he's a vile, toxic human being.
Beyond disgusting.
And that's even when you take out all of the sort of, you know, rape aspects of his personality.
Yeah. I was reading She Said, the book by obviously Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey, who broke the story, which I highly recommend to each and every one of you. It's an astonishing, astonishing piece of journalism. But in the book, they go into a lot more detail about it, and they talk about some of the people who at that point weren't willing to or weren't ready to go on the record. And it's really upsetting, some aspects of it. Now, I know, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow comes in for a lot of shit, just generally in life, and some of it may even be warranted, but she was one of the first people to talk to them. She was one of the first people to go into it. She was not comfortable going on the record initially for the very first story because he suspected she was one of their sources and was outright threatening to her, I think, and that was part of the reason, at least. And literally turned up early to a party and was trying to basically get her alone. She had to lock herself in a bathroom upstairs. But she was also one of the ones who was trying to put them in contact with other movie stars who might be able to help and so on. And one of the things she was saying was that, like, she was so disturbed by the fact that he used her success against other people. And he sort of held her up as, look what happens when you go along with me, which she actually hadn't. Mm-hmm. But, you know, obviously they don't know that. And used her to kind of leverage other people into his orbit. So even the people that escaped, like Kate Beckinsale, like Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, Angelina Jolie was hit on, but again, you know, was able to get away. They were still made part of this horrific scheme. He's an outrageously toxic individual, and I have the utmost respect for all the women who came out and spoke out against him, because it took, and that's one of the things, again, that the book makes clear, it took such extraordinary courage.
God, yes, absolutely.
And not just from these actresses, but from these, you know, former Miramax assistants and workers and just normal women who finally got the courage to speak out against all odds. I think they're incredible. Well done.
Yeah.
Well done indeed. It's a bit of heavy-duty opening to the old podcast this week, isn't it?
Global Apocalypse and Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah. So let's talk about something that will cheer everybody up. Okay. Some Marvel Studios news. Hey, Helen? Hey?
Oh, well, the news that the Falcon and the Winter Soldier has also been delayed because of bloody coronavirus?
No. Tell you this. Yes, Steve wouldn't have been stopped by it.
No.
Hey.
He would as an old man.
He's still got the super soldier serum coursing through his veins.
Which is how we've last saw him.
Yeah, he's a super soldier.
He's not
he's
anymore.
An old super soldier.
He hasn't stopped being a super soldier. He's just incredibly old.
Like a super soldier.
He would throw his shield right at the coronavirus.
He gave it away.
That's true. Fuck then, isn't he?
Yes.
He would throw his shield at the coronavirus.
Helen, it's scientifically proven.
You're like those people firing guns at it, you know, firing guns at the wind.
Yeah, you're
don't do that.
You're basically a Florida man right now.
Yeah.
That's what you are.
Don't do that. What I was talking about was the news that Richard E. Grant has joined Disney Plus's soon-to-be-pushed-back Loki.
No, come on. Disney Plus is going to keep going, I'm sure.
I mean, Disney Plus launches next week here in the UK, so, you know.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah.
We'll have stuff to do when we're in isolation.
Oh, perhaps we can hear about that on the Pilot TV podcast, can we, James?
Yes, you can.
Christ, oh, fucking mighty. Good. Well done. Well done. Well done, everybody. But no, because I think things are filming right now, and movie production and TV show production is going to be hit pretty hard by this as well, don't you think?
Why do you think that Tom Hanks was in Australia? He was making the Elvis movie for Baz Luhrmann.
That's a terrible joke.
Well, it's not a joke.
Oh, it's not a joke. It was actually a fact.
It's an actual fact.
Okay,
yeah.
Moving news. It was in the format of a joke. Why was Tom Hanks in Australia? Answer, to get to the other side or something. I thought that's what you were going to go for, but no, you...
I was literally telling you.
It was a nugget of news.
It was.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I just thought in the news section it might be appropriate to deliver a nugget of news, but I see now where I went wrong.
Anyway, Richard E. Grant's in Loki, the show, not the character.
Thespian City.
It is, isn't it?
I'm up for it.
I was going to say he'd be playing Loki's dad, but we've seen Loki's dad.
How old do you think he is?
Richard E. Grant. He's in his 60s.
How old is Tom Hiddleston? Oh, yeah, okay.
In his 30s.
Yeah, 30s, yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, it does work.
No, I guess I'm used to Loki's dad being a lot older than that.
In his 70s.
Well, Richard E. Grant looks great. What can I say?
Yeah, but you can see him as a capricious, tall, Loki-esque figure, can't you?
Yeah, someone said he looks like an older Loki.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he?
And now that's all I can see.
Maybe he is an older Yoki.
Maybe he is an older Loki.
Older Yoki?
Sure.
Yoki is an egg. Let's see what else is happening in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Finn Diesel, who has apparently... Well, he's just confirming lots of things. Anyone sticks a microphone in front of Finn Diesel's face, he confirms 6 different projects. I have to admit, I love him. I love how much he wills projects into existence just by talking about them enough so that people go, I guess we'll pay for that then, Finn. I want to do Bloodshot. Okay, let's do Bloodshot.
There's a cinematic universe. Tell him about the honey mummy.
He sounds like the honey monster.
I just said the honey monster.
Oh, I can
tell him about the honey mummy.
I see what you're saying.
Tell you what, Sugar Puffs have been rebranded Honey Monster Puffs.
Have they?
And they have changed the recipe and they suck a couple of years ago. They've taken out much of the sugar.
Do they still give you Sugar Puff Wee?
No, they don't. Because they don't have the same taste.
Did you buy a box?
Yeah, I bought a box, yeah. So I wanted to see if they, you know, were the same, but
check.
They don't. Anyway,
Vin Diesel
has said in an interview many, many things, but he said principally that the Guardians of the Galaxy will appear in Thor: Love and Thunder.
It's hardly a shock, is it?
I think that's good.
It's great.
Hooray.
Hooray.
For how long?
It's.
I mean, probably 5 minutes, but that's not the point.
The Asgardians of the Galaxy.
Good news.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Orsi has found himself a new job.
Oh, that's nice. He's left Nando's. That's an in-joke.
Yes, he's doing...
there's a guy in the Nando's we go to who looks like Roberto Orsi. It's
very true. He is doing a new Spider-Man spin-off. So he's working on that for the non-MCU side of that particular world. So taking place in the Venom/Morbius-verse.
Yeah.
No idea what it's going to be. Or
this is great movie.
Whether it'll be any good, but he's doing one. So, you know.
Richard E. Grant's Loki, but we don't know who he's playing. The Guardians of the Galaxy are in Thor 4. That was discussed for 25 seconds. And now we're going...
Yeah. Bob Orsi's got a job. That's the news story.
But we don't know what it is.
But we definitely want some peri peri fries and spicy rice with that.
I don't like Nando's. There you go.
Come on, Helen.
It's true.
What's wrong with
it's
you?
It's true. I don't like Nando's.
Why?
Everything tastes of nothing.
It clearly tastes of nothing. It's covered in peri peri goodness, Helen.
No.
Like they have different spices, Helen.
Yeah, no.
Different levels of spice. Chris is an extra hot man.
So what's happening with Spider-Man?
Oh, yes. So Roberto Orsi is writing this, and I just wonder if they could have gone for his more decisive cousin, Roberto Anzi.
Wow!
And the coronavirus has already struck Chris's brain!
Has it though?
I'll do that joke again until it gets the reception it deserves.
Well, it's going to be a long night.
I'm going to lock that fucking door. I'm excited about this. We knew that Peter Jackson was going to make a documentary about the Beatles, and specifically the album session that started off as Get Back and turned into Let It Be, and it was essentially the last album the Beatles released, but not the last one they recorded. But it was a very tempestuous recording session, and so this is now going to come out as a Disney documentary in September, we hope, fingers crossed.
Who knows?
The Beatles Get Back is what it's going to be called. So so as to differentiate it. We boring you, James? You okay? So as to differentiate it from the Let It Be documentary.
Have you seen, Chris, the original Let It Be?
I've never seen it.
I don't think it was legally available. Am I wrong?
That's one of the reasons why I haven't seen it.
I did have a VHS many moons ago.
It's
very entertaining, but it's very fractious. They all seem like they kind of hate each other, except for Ringo, who's trying to keep the peace. But it's legendary in terms of biopic drama. But from what I heard somewhere, it might have been on a Beatles podcast, I think, or something, that what Peter Jackson is doing with the footage that he's found is reconfiguring it into something slightly more truthful, which is something less fractious and friendlier and nicer. Where the truth lies in what was going on at the time is probably in between the two, I guess. But I've heard that's what he was doing with it.
I think that's probably fair, really, don't you? Like, I mean, I'm sure there was fractiousness in any group, as there is among all of us a lot of time. But
at the
same time,
fuck you, is there fractiousness?
It was bad at the end of the Beatles.
Yeah, I don't think that's controversial. But it wasn't, you know.
It wasn't good. Yeah. It wasn't good.
But also, it's got the rooftop gig, right?
Yes. Yeah. What a great. Yeah, because there was so much infighting towards the end of the Beatles. It wasn't ideal. And that was an attempt to get things back on track and a little bit back to basics in terms of their music as well. Mm. I'm really excited about this. I think it's going to be fantastic. It says here, the film will showcase the warmth, camaraderie, and humour. I love this. The warmth and camaraderie. Fuck off, John. No, fuck off, Paul. Fuck off, Ringo. Fuck off, George. You know, it's basically going to be Chris, isn't it?
They're from Liverpool.
That was fucking brilliant.
Famously from Liverpool.
Now I want to watch Animaniacs.
I'm interested in what's going on in the wake of The Invisible Man. Jason Blum has said he wants to make a Frankenstein film.
Here for it.
He's talking about Karen Kusama directing a Dracula film.
Yes.
She's great. She did Girlfight. She did Destroyer recently. I think she did an episode of The Outsider, which was very good, which I watched recently. So she'd be an amazing fit for what they're doing with these Universal monsters, if indeed they're going to be continuing in the same vein of what Lee Whannell did with The Invisible Man. Who knows? Because what he did was his vision. It was such a one-off. I believe this is not a shared universe or anything like that. But I'm sure if they're Blumhouse films, they'll be of a piece in some way. But obviously what he did with The Invisible Man was only a suspension of disbelief in terms of the man being invisible. But other than that, it was a kind of a real-world threat situation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you do that with an immortal vampire?
Well, it depends if it's an immortal vampire. Like, it depends if it's a, you know, oh, there's a blood thingy that makes you go woo.
Right. There's a blood thingy coronavirus that makes you go woo.
I don't want to dazzle you with science.
So in your Dracula tale, it's fine just as long as he washes his hands for 20 seconds. And he stays indoors. That's what Castle Dracula is.
I
am just self-isolating.
Where's he from?
Liverpool.
Is he unknown sixth member of the Beatles? Sixth? Fifth?
I want to hold your hand.
Oh, God.
No, I want to see that movie.
James bringing the music knowledge.
I know. Oh, told you.
The sixth member of the Beatles.
Famously, they were called The Fab Four.
In fairness, I was getting confused with Fast Five. There are a couple of people who have been known as the Fifth Beatle, who James was obviously referencing.
There was
Pete
Best, Stuart Sutcliffe, and Vlad Dracul, the famous warlord, the Turkish warlord. Oh my God,
that's amazing. Anyway, maybe it'll be like the strain, you know, where vampirism is like a strain of disease.
I find myself in times of trouble.
What is happening?
I just want a vampire movie by the Beatles now. I'm sorry. It's really bad.
Vampire Beatles. Hollywood.
Not a bad idea.
But no, I'd be really interested to see what Kusama and Blumhouse could do with Dracula and make it that sort of, you know, slightly more grounded potentially thing, especially after that fucking dreadful BBC Dracula at Christmas, no, which I'm still not over.
It was 2/3 brilliant.
Yeah. No, it was 1/3 brilliant, 1/3 pretty good, and 1/3 fucking dreadful.
I thought the second episode was the best. That was great. But yes, the third episode was
Drek.
Pants.
Yeah. I've seen Goran Višnjić. Is going to be, or Visnich, I believe it is, he's Croatian, is going to be Dracula and the Brides. Which
I'm here
kind
for
of,
that.
Yeah.
What's the Brides?
What's that?
It's the one about Dracula's Brides.
Yeah.
Okay, so at the moment we have...
He's a trigamist.
We have the... yeah. That's good.
I like God.
One, two, three, Brides! So there's the last voyage of the Detmer, which is Demeter.
Named after the goddess of the earth.
Yes, I knew
Mother
that.
Persephone.
Obviously, I knew that. And that's the one that Dexter Fletcher had attached to. And then we have this one with Goran Visnich, and then this one, the Karen Kazamba one, which sounds cool. Hmm. I'm up for it. Sounds a bit Morbius-y though, Helen, your pitch.
That's true, actually. I take it all back. I mean, hey, who knows? Morbius could be great. Whenever we see it, whenever that is, we don't know.
We don't.
Oh, God.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I want a Dracula film that isn't full Dracula. If it's just something to do with a blood disease or blah, blah,
well,
blah.
Well, I'm not saying that will be the case. And yeah. To be honest, I would also be open to... I mean, you know, they've drabbled with... Drabbled? They have drabbled. They have dabbled...
Coronavirus.
They have...
They came into this podcast with every attempt, something in the intention of being respectful.
They have dabbled with mythology, obviously, in like The Nun and Annabelle and all of those ones. Like it's been more recent mythology, maybe, but there is... the room for craziness in this world. So
yeah.
I don't think it's too much of a stretch to think there might be an immortal vampire out there somewhere.
Speaking of immortal vampires, did you watch the trailer for Soul?
Yes.
Not yet, no, because I've been
all the feels.
Since it came out. Yeah.
All the feels.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it was an unexpected plot turn for Pixar.
That's not how segues work, by the way.
You can't just
simply say something that's completely unconnected to the thing you're about to introduce. That's not how it works.
I beg to differ.
Speaking of falling off a cliff, let's talk about... No, that's not how
it works.
Have
you watched it? Have you seen it? Have you seen this old track?
Yeah, I was standing next to you when we watched
it. Yes, you were. Yes. That's true. Yeah, looks great. Looks like it's going to be another tearjerker, though.
Yes,
you'd hope so.
Mm. And that's coming out in July/August/September/October/November.
/2021/2022/2023.
What we need right now is a doctor, a Pete doctor. And that movie looks good.
Yeah, it does.
It does very much look like a follow-up to Inside Out, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
It's got beautiful different animation styles as well. Like it jumps between various different sort of like aesthetics, which I am very much here for.
Mm-hmm. Jungle Cruise trailer. What did we think of the Jungle Cruise trailer?
I mean, it does not stop looking mummy-y, does it? It doesn't
This I couldn't work out if
bell.
It was self-aware or not.
No, well, I think it is. I think it is. It's one of these things where... The film itself could be a bit meh, but I think Emily Blunt and The Rock together, there's just something quite compelling about that. And what they did with this, which I really enjoyed at D23, was they did, I don't know if they put it online, it was so funny, they did two trailers. They did one from her point of view and one from his point of view, and they had each one of them present it as a kind of, this
like
is the
marriage
film.
Story.
Yeah, but it was really, really nicely done.
They've done that with the posters this week, with each of them standing in front of the other on the poster and sort of rejigging it. So.
It's fun, and they have a really good chemistry together. So I'm quite interested in this. I will say the Jungle Cruise ride is rubbish. But then so is Pirates of the Caribbean, and that didn't affect the film, so...
Yeah, well, didn't it?
Well, the first one's very good.
The first one's great, come on.
Not so much the others, but the first one's excellent.
All right, fine.
It's got an undead monkey.
It's a small world after all.
A small, small world.
So Joe and Anthony Russo...
Yes.
Are apparently teaming up with two up-and-coming young producers for their next movie, Exit West, which is a drama... by the Pakistani author Mohsin Hamid, and it will be directed by Yand Manj, apparently, and it is set in an unidentified Middle Eastern country and centers around a young couple who escaped from their home during a violent war, and they join other migrants traveling to safe havens via carefully guarded doors. Each door takes them to different locations across the world where the relationship is tested by their struggle to find food, adequate shelter, and a sense of belonging amongst immigrant communities. Now, the interesting thing is the up-and-coming young producers that the Russos are teaming up with in this are Barack and Michelle Obama. You may have heard of them.
I've never heard of them.
Yes.
Oh, the sixth and seventh members of the Beatles.
Wait, these doors, they're travelling via doors.
There seems to be some sort of metaphysical element.
What, like the Adjustment Bureau?
Yeah, is this the Adjustment Bureau?
I wonder.
Or is it Monsters, Inc.? Like,
I haven't read the book, so but it sounds really, really cool. It's being named here as a drama.
Any of them wearing hats?
I don't know.
But I thought
you might latch onto the Obama thing rather than the doors and the hats.
Yeah, I mean, I like the Adjustment Bureau. Somebody has to. So.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, not the Adjustment Bureau.
No, I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying people have knocked it.
Another film with the blunt factor.
That is. This sounds interesting. And Michelle and Barack Obama's first film that I saw, at least, was American Factory, which is a fantastic documentary. So far they've got quite a good record as far as I'm concerned.
Did that win the Oscar, was it, that one?
It won the Oscar. So it is good, I feel, you know.
Yeah. I mean, they are actually up and coming. They don't have a massive IMDb producer profile.
They do have a massive profile. Yeah. So, you know.
They're up and coming producers.
Even bigger than the Russo brothers, I would say.
Yes. So. I'm not sure about that.
Well, that's true. That's fair.
No. Barack and Michelle Obama did many, many things, but he never directed Avengers Endgame, so quite frankly, he's a failure. Anything else to talk about?
That's why he teamed up with the Russos.
Perhaps he is. He's like, I need some of your success, guys.
Avengers success,
that reflected glory. Please.
I was just watching the other day the... I think it was the White House Correspondents' Dinner speech from, I think, his first year in office. It was John Hodgman doing that. Have you guys seen this? It's online. I highly recommend it. We've all got time sitting at home right now.
Is this
so you can
the
watch
one with
it.
The Lion King skit, or was that the next one?
No, this is the one where he talks about how Barack Obama has finally united the two, you know, warring tribes of the U.S., the nerds and the jocks. and he goes into his nerd and his jock credentials, and it's a lot of fun.
It's not the one where Obama dissed Trump and then made Trump become president.
Yeah,
that was
awkward.
Unfortunate.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Oops. Or like when Boris Johnson was invited on Have I Got News For You, and everyone went, oh, he's a lovely guy. Let's make him prime minister.
Mm. Okay.
Got a little bit political there on the Old Empire podcast. Sorry about that.
There was also the good news this week.
Oh,
that
yes.
Parasite has become the highest grossing foreign language film ever in the UK. So well done, everybody who went to see Parasite.
I didn't see Mel Gibson do one of those congratulatory posters to pass on to them.
Maybe it's a little bit specific. Maybe that only happens if you're the highest grossing film of all time.
Yes. Imagine if someone had to do it every time a movie passed them at the box office. But yes, well done. Anyway, enough talk about box office, because there was some very, very sad news as well this week. The legendary Swedish actor Max von Sydow passed away at the age of 90. And this
too
guy,
soon.
Mm. Yeah.
A good inning, so.
Yeah.
Before he edged to slip. And hell of a filmography. Hell of a filmography.
Mm. You're referring, of course, to The Exorcist. he has an incredible, incredible career. And I feel like it's... It felt almost kind of seamless. Like, he seemed to go from playing this, frankly, gorgeous young man in The Seven Seal, this kind of, you know, incredibly golden figure.
He always looked 90.
Yeah, but this is it. To then The Exorcist. And he feels like he's been playing the old man ever since then, for like 40 years. From The Exorcist, not flattering to me, but I first saw him in Flash Gordon as Ming the Merciless, where he was incredible.
Same.
But yeah, he's been so many great things recently. Minority Report, he was in Shutter Island, Game of Thrones, of course, for about half a second.
Force Awakens,
as Lor San
Tekka.
Yeah, not a big role, but he was brilliant in it. He's just incredible.
Yeah, he was the sort of guy who could go from, you know, his long collaboration with Ingmar Bergman to taking the Hollywood stuff, and also taking kind of weird, esoteric, sometimes fantasy-tinged Hollywood stuff, but he was tremendous. I mean, he was the voice of Viggo Le Carpathian. Did you know that?
In the Ghostbusters game, yeah. He was in Judge Dredd, remember that?
Who was he in that?
He was Judge Fargo.
Yes.
Memorable.
Yeah, memorable role, that one.
I remember
Robin Williams from, do you remember What Dreams May Come?
Yes.
This film I really enjoyed. It didn't get particularly well reviewed, but beautiful, beautiful film, and he's great in that.
Which was he the dad? Was he the like grandfather in that?
He's a kind of, isn't he? As I recall, it's been many, many years since I've seen it. Isn't he becomes a kind of a guide figure in the afterlife?
But aren't the guides in the afterlife his kids?
That's right, isn't it? Yes, massive spoiler.
Sorry,
but that's one of his kids, isn't it? Yeah, very, very true.
Okay.
If you haven't seen What Dreams May Come, Helen's just ruined that for you, but it's a great film. Go and watch it.
But yes, so obviously there's some tremendous movies he made with Ingmar Bergman. We mentioned The Seventh Seal already, the likes of Wild Strawberries as well, The Virgin Spring, then some of his great work in Hollywood as well. We haven't mentioned 3 Days of the Condor yet. He is terrific in that as a hitman who is pursuing Robert Redford all the way through that film, and he has an incredible speech to Redford towards the end of that film, which is extraordinary. He was in Needful Things, of course, not the best Stephen King adaptation ever, but he was great in it as Leland Gaunt. He was in Conan the Barbarian. He just had this wonderful filmography, and you know, it was in Force Awakens as well, and he was just a real one-off also. Yeah, for me, just to go back to the idea that he just always looked like he was 90 years old. Mm-hmm. He was wearing prosthetics for The Exorcist, but they were actually to de-age him. He came in looking 90, and they were like, no, we need you to look 70. Can you do that? But yeah, he was tall, he was gaunt, he was commanding. He was tremendous.
Mm. He could only have been 40-something in The Exorcist.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Incredible screen presence.
Yeah, they properly aged him up. I mean, to cast him based on that...
Mm.
You know, because presumably Friedkin, who'd been a cinephile, would have seen his movies with Ingmar Bergman and would have gone, okay, I want that guy. But to have the vision to go, I'm going to cast you, but you're 30 years too young for the part, but I know you can pull it off.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you don't question it at any moment. I think that's one of the reasons why he had such longevity in his career, because most people just thought he was 70. And they just kept hiring him to do stuff where he was playing a 70-year-old man.
He's one of those, I mean, he brought such amazing gravitas to something, didn't he? Mm. You put him in something and it gave your film credibility, I think. It's not quite the same, but putting Brando in Superman, suddenly you've got all that weight and that heritage, movie weight. And that heritage, and that's why JJ cast him in Star Wars, right?
Oh, absolutely.
You plant him there at the beginning, and you go, all right, this is the business. And I was actually always miffed that he was only in that film for 30 seconds.
Yeah, we'll blame Kylo Ren for that.
I always have to.
but you did kind of want to see him just hanging out with Princess Leia or something.
It was a bit of a waste. Hmm.
But it's mad, isn't it? We talk an awful lot on this podcast about people having iconic roles, and he has, you know, whenever he passed away, people immediately started going, The Knight from the Seventh Seal, The Exorcist from, what's that film called? And of course, genuinely, Ming the Merciless was a big touchstone for a lot of people.
I mean, that is an incredible performance. Like, he is the thing holding that film together, because let's be honest, God bless him, Sam Jones was perhaps not the greatest actor in the world.
But you got Dalton, and you got Fonsito, and you got Brian Blessed giving it their all and taking it away from that sort of blonde vacuum at the heart of the film.
And that's what you needed, because and Fonsito is the one of those three who's in it most. Obviously, Dalton only gets really a scene, Blessed gets, what, 2 scenes? So you've got to have Ming there. God, he's good.
And you kind of buy him as a destroyer of worlds.
I absolutely bought him as a destroyer of the world.
Yeah.
I'm still afraid to go into space.
He nominated twice for an Oscar, for Pele the Conqueror in 1989, and then for 2012's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, where he didn't speak, right? He was silent in that?
He was the tenant, I remember. I don't remember much else.
It was
not the greatest film. I think that Oscar nomination was very much a, oh my God, we haven't given Max von Sydow an Oscar.
Yeah. And they still fucking haven't. And they didn't give him anything honorary either. But he is an all-time great, and we're very, very sad indeed to hear of his passing. Time now for a question from one of our listeners. And I can't believe we're at this point either, because it seems like we've been talking for an hour, but here we are. And this is a really good question. This is a really good question, you guys. And it comes from email, and the best questions come from email. It comes from Johnny Youngs, London, and he asks, as The Aeronauts goes on a certain streaming service, Amazon, it's a good time to ask, has any movie that has tried to recapture the on-screen chemistry of a co-star pairing ever outdone itself? So The Aeronauts obviously reunites Eddie Redmayne with the hot air balloon from Jupiter Ascending.
Felicity Jones!
That's... Also, Felicity Jones, they start together in The Theory of Everything, and then it tries to rekindle their alleged chemistry and doesn't quite succeed. But are there any other examples of that happening where the second, third, fourth movie in a partnership actually does exceed the first movie?
War of the Roses.
You're sticking that over Romancing the Stone and...
Well, it's the like, yeah, it's the one afterwards. You know, it's the one.
You know what? You might have something
meets
there.
It's the definition of the question.
Yeah, okay. I know. I'm just saying.
All right. Like I said, that's nailed it. If you want to have your question about the Emperor Book.
You've got mail.
Have I?
Yes.
That's nice.
It's not as good, though.
Well,
is it?
What is there, there is a camp that would argue that they are better in You've Got Mail than Sleepless in Seattle.
I mean, it's not bad, but it's not as good as Sleepless in Seattle, I think, personally.
Well, fine.
Technically speaking, it is also a film starring Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, but it's not Sleepless in Seattle. It's not anywhere. It's not fit to...
Oh, I've got the answer. Oh. Joe versus the Volcano was the first one they were in together. Yes. So really, Sleepless in Seattle is the right answer.
And Helen wins on a technicality.
There is also, of course, the Spencer Tracy, Catherine Hepburn films, any of which after the first one would qualify.
Yes.
So, I don't know. Adam's Rib.
There is the La La Land to Crazy Stupid Love.
Yeah, but I don't like La La Land.
Yes, but you're wrong.
That's maybe.
Yes, your wrongness is absolute. That said, Crazy Stupid Love is really, really good. So that's a bit of a toss-up, isn't it?
It is really, really good, but La La Land was also good, and they completely worked together in that film, and it was enormously successful, and you buy it. I mean, it's quite heartbreaking if you buy into their chemistry.
Hepburn and Tracy, just to we'll go back to them for a second, started off with Woman of the Year.
Yep.
And they went on to make Keeper for Flame, Without Love, The Sea of Grass, State of the Union, Adam's Rib, Pat and Mike, Desk Set, and then he finished with Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Yeah.
So what do you sense of better, Lala?
I reckon Adam's Rib. Mm-hmm. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is aged. Let's just say that. Desk Set, that's the one where she's the expert in research and stuff, and he's trying to replace her with a computer. That's fun. But it's not as good as Adam's Rib, which has them opposite each other in court.
Okay. But, see, that's the thing. That's slightly different, I think, from the Emma Stone, Ryan Gosling thing.
Why?
Because I think that's just accidental casting. Oh, fucking hell. Shots fired.
Did you like Crazy Stupid Love, though?
I thought they were cute in it together. I really did like them in that, yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I don't think it's the same thing. I think that's just a director really likes these people and they just happen to have worked with each other in the past. Whereas Tracy and Hepburn, Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon,
oh God,
Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor, they came, they very quickly established themselves as partnerships and people wanted to see them again in movies, not necessarily playing the same characters. So they see Wilder and Pryor in Silver Streak, then again in Stir Crazy, and then obviously the diminishing returns really kicks in with See No Evil, Hear No Evil. I couldn't even remember the name of the other one they did, and I've forgotten that already. But
Another You,
yeah. Another
very
You.
Very bad.
So should we really be talking about Laurel and Hardy here?
No, I don't think so, because they came as a prepackaged as a double act.
What about Hope and Crosby?
No, because they're all part of the same franchise.
Okay.
So are we saying that the film has to be better second up, or the relationship is better? Because I'd throw The Lake House into this particular ring.
Wow.
Because it's same.
No, bear with me. One of my more popular opinions. Not that it's a better film than Speed, but their pairing in it kind of delivers on all of the promise that Speed gave you, all the sexual tension of Speed, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. I love The Lake House and fuck you all.
Wow.
Does it deliver on sexual tension, though? Because they don't really...
What is the meat
in The Lake House?
Time and space. The Lake House?
Oh, I can't
tell you without actually giving away the plot of the film, but it's...
I'm not watching it.
There's letters that are going between these two people, but it's because they're 2 years apart.
Yeah, they're in the same lake house, but they're living in different times and they're exchanging letters. And it's just like they're separated.
Why did the first
temporally.
Person move out of
and
the
then
lake
house? And the lake house goes over 50 miles an hour.
That's right, it explodes.
Yeah,
I think it was called The House That Couldn't Slow Down.
What happens at the end of the lake house?
I'm not spoiling the end of the lake house. People should see this film.
Does Jeff Daniels die? What happens?
Dennis Hopper gets decapitated.
Do they meet?
I'm not telling you.
Do they meet?
I don't remember.
They meet about halfway through. They do meet about
halfway through. I don't remember the ending.
They meet at a party about halfway through.
They
That's
do meet. But it's like, but how does it end? I genuinely don't remember.
I kind of do, but I'm not going to spoil it.
You don't remember either.
I kind of do.
Is it a sad ending? It's a bit of
not a happy ending.
It is a sad. It is
yeah,
a happy
I remember.
Ending.
I remember being quite
no,
weepy.
It is a happy ending.
I don't think it is.
No, because like,
Neither of us remember how this film ends. I really like it, though, even though I don't know how it ends.
And it's better than Speed, apparently, according to you.
It's never better than Speed. I'm saying the relationship in it, the core of relationship in it, is better than the relationship in Speed.
Okay.
If we're talking platonic partnerships,
yes.
Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly, Talladega Nights, to Step Brothers.
That's good.
And I wouldn't say Step Brothers is entirely unromantic.
And then the very pinnacle of that is Holmes and Watson.
Yeah.
Diminishing returns.
I have enjoyed neither of them in any of those films, but sure.
But you don't. You hate joy and comedy, so.
All true.
It's a fucking Catalina wine mixer. Yes, I'm absolutely bang up for any film starring them. So Jack Lemmon, Walter Matthau. Okay, so they start off with The Fortune Cookie, 1966.
Right.
Then they have The Odd Couple.
See, that's probably the best one.
Yeah.
But The Front Page. Fucking love The Front
Buddy
Page.
Buddy, not great. JFK, I'm not allowing that.
That's not.
Get away with your JFK. Grumpy Old Men. The Grass Harp, don't remember that one.
No.
Grumpier Old Men.
It was all right.
Out to Sea, and then The Nadir of The Odd Couple 2 was their last film together. So it's The Odd Couple, but they're great, wonderful, warm pairing that you want to see
on screen. The Front Page is a classic for a reason as well. Like that is pretty great. If you don't know it, The Front Page was originally written as a play. It was filmed in the early 30s. Then it was made into His Girl Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was this Front Page. Then it was Switching Channels.
Switching Channels, yes.
It's been done a lot with
Burt
Reynolds and Christopher Reeve
and
Kathleen Turner.
Correct. Who is in?
Romancing the Stone and the one I mentioned at the beginning, The War of the Roses.
Back full circle. And if I didn't have a compulsion to name De Niro and Pacino, that would be the end of this bit. But I've got to mention De Niro and Pacino.
It is a happy ending to The Lake House.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh my God.
I knew it.
You may have just ruined the film for me.
What happened?
I could have sworn it ended on a sad note.
Yeah, but she writes him to warn him that he shouldn't.
Yes,
you know, and then
that's right. Oh my God.
Don't get on that bus.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Okay, just to end this, I will put it to you that Avengers Infinity War is better than The Nanny Diaries. Therefore, Evans and Johansson.
But it's not better than The Perfect Score, so. I'm sorry.
I'm telling Avengers HQ that you said that.
Oh, like they don't already know. Like they've got this linked up to a system. Boop, boop. What's it? What's happening, sir? USB and mildly critical of the MCU, sir. Oh my God, batten down the hatches. Self-isolate. Not going to happen. Anyway, De Niro and Pacino started off with The Middling Heat. They finished with The Middling The Irishman, but in between was the masterpiece that is Righteous Kill. There you go. Microphone drop.
Oh,
De Niro and Pacino.
I think you can talk more about De Niro and Pesci, who've gone from Raging Bull, Goodfellas, Casino, and The Irishman, but I see them as a little bit more of a screen pair than... I don't think so.
Maybe, but... You're not selling these movies necessarily on De Niro and Pacheci? De Niro and Pacheci.
Wow. Robert Pacheci.
Is that what you call their partnership?
I'm Joe Pacheci, you fuck.
You fuck.
You fuck. Joe Pacheci.
This is Elmo goes R-rated. Yeah. Very confused.
He's, of course, the seventh member of the Beatles.
How many are there?
I've completely lost count.
I want to hold your hand, you fuck. So, yes, De Niro Pacino. But there's loads of examples.
Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Yes.
Yes. Mm. So which one's the best one?
Hot Fuzz.
Hot Fuzz.
Yes, Hot Fuzz. I was just trying to, you know.
What's your favourite Stiller Wilson?
Tenenbaums. Wow. But they're not a partnership.
Yeah, they're not really a partnership.
They're just in films.
Mm. What do you mean they're in films?
Come on, they're
in the same films. But
Starsky and Hutch, Zoolander 2.
It's kind of Zoolander.
Yeah, but I don't think we're talking about that. I don't think we're talking about films that are capitalizing on chemistry in the same way. It's just like, let's cast these two guys again.
But they're both really, really good looking.
ridiculously good looking.
Only one of them can't turn left, so that's a big thing.
He's just not an ambi-turner, all right?
Jesus Christ.
Which brings us back to Kathleen Turner, and the whole thing
and
goes
that
through full
is
circle
the end
again.
Of the segment. Thank Christ. If you want to have your question read out in the EPRA podcast, please, we'll need stuff to keep us occupied over the next few weeks. Do send them in to us. We're on Twitter as at EPRA Magazine. Use the hashtag EPRA Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. We're on Facebook as well. And email us, podcast@empireonline.com, as Johnny Youngs did. How exciting. Time now for this week's guest. And yes, you'll be delighted to know that we do have guests lined up for the next few episodes as well. After that, if you are an A-list star and you're absolutely feeling 100%, then do get in touch with me, and maybe we'll do something over the phone or over Skype, or maybe you'll risk it for a biscuit and come into the pod booth and we'll give it a go.
Okay.
Just at me, at Chris Hewitt, slide into my DMs. You know you want to. Will Smith. To name but one. Anyway, this week's guest is a wonderful British actor who has been putting together quietly a fantastic CV over the last few years. So she has been in recently the likes of Motherless Brooklyn. She was great in that film. She was in Fast Color, The Cloverfield Paradox, Beauty and the Beast, of course, Free State of Jones, Belle, Ama Asante's Belle as well. She's currently filming Loki, apparently.
Yes, she is, yeah.
She's in Loki. Very excited indeed. She is, of course, the wonderful Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who this week stars. She's one of the many stars of Misbehaviour, which is about the 1970 Miss World pageant and attempts to derail it and expose it as the sexist farrago that it was. And she's very, very good in it indeed as Miss Grenada. And she was talking to Beth Webb for this interview. Now, this was Beth Webb's first time interviewing anyone for the podcast. And I believe there was a slight technical snafu. Am I right in this, Jimbo?
But no one will know because we did ADR and we fixed it in post.
And have you heard the finished result?
No, but I'm sure it sounds brilliant.
Cool.
Okay, then.
Yeah, so Beth's headphones were rained on and broke and something else happened and the microphone didn't work. So only her side of the interview did not record. But we came into the pod booth later on and we looped it, as all great films do. A little bit of ADR, a little bit of post. And so
did you
look
Beth's lines or did she do her
No, she made
lines.
Me leave the room. She wouldn't allow me to sit here and listen to her do it. But yes, right, okay. She looped them. I'm sure it's absolutely perfect. You will not know.
Seamless.
Seamless.
Seamless editing.
Seamless.
Here we go then. Gugu Mbatha-Raw talking to someone who sounds like Beth Webb in a completely different room. Enjoy.
It's the future.
It's the future. Yeah. She's a pioneer. Who knew?
So congratulations on the film.
Oh, thank you.
And what a perfect time of year for it to come out as well. I think we need something uplifting given the current British weather.
Yes, exactly.
I think a large part of the appeal and part of the reason why this film came into fruition is because a lot of people didn't really know about this historical event. And I wanted to know when you first came to learn about it.
It was really when the script was sent to me. My agent called me up and said, I've got this really interesting script about Miss World. And I was like, Miss World? Okay. And I knew it had come from the casting director, Nina Gold, who I've met many, many times. And I know she does incredible work. So I knew she had great taste. And so I read the script and it was just so sparkly. I just love the wit and the mischief and the point of view of the film being so firmly rooted in the female gaze. And I just loved the fact that this really happened, you know, this sort of collision of, you know, the women's liberation movement storming the Miss World ceremony at the same year that the first woman of colour won the competition. I just thought it was a sort of fantastically potent time.
And it was actually quite shocking. I mean, to watch it in today's context, I found it quite shocking in that, you know, in the same breath that the contestants' names were announced, their measurements were as well. And I think it's a good sign that we've come as far as we have, but also, yeah, something definitely to reflect on.
Really was shocking. I mean, just how deeply objectifying they are, you know. And I think for me, going back in, you know, in research, watching the real ceremony in 1970, and as you say, they give everyone measurements, you know, and then Bob Hope himself as the host, his jokes are just so terribly misogynistic and offensive and objectifying. And the fact that the women have to turn their bottoms to the audience, you know, to get to be fully appraised. I mean, it's like comparing them to cattle and animals. And I just, it shocked me. And I just thought, wow, yes, how far we've come and what's acceptable then and what's acceptable now. Although there's still obviously a lot of work to do.
Yeah. And you went out to meet Jennifer as well to research the role a little bit better. Where was it that you met her?
Yeah, it was amazing, actually. I got Jennifer Hostin's email from our director. And, you know, I was dying to meet her, but I knew she was based in Canada now. And so I emailed her and we had a lovely sort of back and forth. And then we spoke on the phone. And after that, I just had this very romantic idea about meeting her in Grenada. I'd never been to Grenada, and the film was all set to be shot entirely in London around the competition. So I knew, you know, we wouldn't get to go there as some sort of glamorous location. So I emailed her and said, you know, I'd love to meet you. I don't suppose you're making any trips to Grenada soon, but, you know, I'd be willing to fly out and meet you there and would love to learn more about your culture. And to my absolute delight, she agreed. So it was amazing. I mean, you know, I got to spend a few days there with her. I took my mum. She took her daughter. So we had a really, it was like a women's meeting in Grenada. And, you know, just for me to be able to really enrich the experience for myself, you know, listen to her dialect, have her show me where she grew up, just get a sense of the culture that she was coming from, so that I would just, you know, have that to fuel my imagination when we were filming in rainy Wimbledon in January.
And what was the key piece of advice that she gave you? What was something that really stuck with you?
Well, she didn't really give me advice as such, you know, in terms of how to play her. I think for me, you know, I suppose I really took away that she felt like she was an ambassador for her country. I think that, you know, at that time, Grenada didn't have its independence from the UK. So, you know, a lot of people didn't know what this small island in the Caribbean was, or even where it was. A lot of people confused it with Grenada in Spain. And, you know, I think she felt quite a serious responsibility to put her, you know, small island on the map. And, but she also, you know, took it all with a pinch of salt, I think, in terms of the beauty side of things. I think, you know, she went with her sister, who was her hairstylist, who unfortunately isn't in the film, but, you know, and her sister always emphasized it was a package deal in terms of the full package, her personality, you know, what she was interested in. It wasn't just, you know, about her looks. So, yeah, there's definitely a maturity, you know, I think, to how she looks back on the whole event.
And then what other research did you have to do for the role? Because what struck me is there's such a physicality to the performance in the pageantry. Mm. I guess I don't mean training sessions, but what other research did you do?
There absolutely was. We had this incredible posture coach who, you know, really worked at the, used to work at the Lucy Clayton Modeling School back in the day, you know, which is the generation of, you know, Joan Collins and Joanna Lumley and, you know, and that era of modeling and posture. So it was amazing. We all sort of had this like Miss World boot camp where, you know, we had these classes and I had some one-on-one sessions with her in terms of how to sit, you know, always crossing your legs at the ankle. How I'm sitting now was really not the ladylike way. And, you know, how to walk. And I think they really did work on their walk. And Jennifer herself, you know, as we see in the film, you know, she really did really work on that and drew a map even of the stage and practiced her movement just so that she would not feel as nervous on the night. So it was quite a bonding experience for all of us 21st century women who are used to slouching over iPhones and, you know, wearing jeans to practice walking in heels. And it's such a different style as well, I think, the posture then, even to how models hold themselves now. I think there was a much more awareness of, you know, standing tall, like you've got a, I'm remembering now the class, standing like you've got a string pulling you up from the top of your head and shoulders back and bottom under. I mean, you know, she was really quite a drill sergeant, but it was great. And I think it really gives the movement and physicality in the film a sense of period authenticity.
I'd like to know a little bit more about your time on set, because I know you've worked in some great female ensembles in the past with A Wrinkle in Time and more recently The Morning Show. But I feel like this is the first time you've really been part of a big female collective on screen. And I'd love to know a little bit more about what life was like on set for you?
It was amazing. I mean, you know, this cast is phenomenal. Obviously, Keira Knightley, Jesse Buckley, Keely Hawes, Leslie Manville. I mean, some of Britain's finest actors and actresses. And, you know, at the helm with Philippa Lowthorpe, our incredible director. It was great. You know, most of my scenes were with the beauty queens and, you know, just an incredibly big ensemble of women and just the energy of that. And also, you know, women from all over the world or from all different backgrounds. So it was such deeply diverse, probably the most diverse cast I've ever worked with, you know, because the casting were very conscious about getting actors that could really speak the language that they were from, you know. So yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful, joyful experience.
And you really have like a special bond with Louise Harrison as well as part of the makeup of the pageant. I really wanted to know a little bit more about how you brought that camaraderie from the set onto the screen.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, there wasn't a lot of time, you know, for rehearsals beyond some read-throughs, you know, working with Larice and Emma Corrin, who plays Miss Africa, South Africa, or Miss Africa South. So, you know, I spent most time with them and also Suki Waterhouse, who plays Miss America. But yeah, it was really, you know, on set, you know, the camaraderie, especially of us all being in our swimsuits. I think, you know, that first day when we had to, it was the scene where these, you know, and Philippa captures it beautifully of this wall of women in bathing swimming suit costumes and this horde of male photographers sort of running at them, you know, and where she places the camera, you know, you really get that sense of how absurd it is, but also the terror of the objectification. And I think we were all in it together. That was the first day that we'd all had to sort of get into our swimsuits together. So we bonded over, you know, shivering.
And then you have, without going into too much plot detail, a very significant scene with Keira Knightley's character Sally. It's not so much a confrontation as it is a conversation between two women from vastly different backgrounds. And I just wanted to know what it was like to film a scene that holds such weight within the film.
Yes, I love that scene. And I think it's so important to the film to really, like you say, it's not a confrontation. It's more of a reckoning, I think, and a sort of a meeting for the first time of these two women from very different sides of the movement and what's going on. And for me, I think it really brought, you know, into a very intimate setting something that had been a very loud and sort of, you know, macro sort of protest, you know, from the pageantry on stage to the protests outside, and then just to have these two women together in a room, just to be able to highlight really, you know, the intersectional nature of, you know, what they were both dealing with. And I think for Jennifer to highlight perhaps what Keira's character Sally may have overlooked in terms of the opportunities that Jennifer had, and maybe the opportunities that she had that she'd maybe taken for granted. So I think it's an important moment in the film to really appreciate, you know, these two women and the different backgrounds they have. And you know, I think it's very contemporary conversation now about, you know, all of these movements that we have, that they're inclusive, that everybody is able to, you know, partake, and that their identity and their journey is allowed and is allowed for, and that there's not judgment about, you know, I think these women are not against each other. They're against the patriarchy, they're against the system, but they're not against the other women. And I think that scene quite poignantly, you know, highlights that.
I'd love to know why you think the story needed to be told today in 2020 and what significance that holds.
Well, I think it's wonderful it's coming out around International Women's Day, or now International Women's Month. I think we have a whole month, women. Yay. But yeah, I think, you know, obviously the parallels are, you know, quite clear in the last few years in terms of Me Too and Time's Up and, you know, the women's marches and movements and, you know, women once again, you know, breaking their silences over inequality and abuses of power. So I think what's exciting, you know, about this film and lovely about this film is I think a lot of those issues we've been dealing with are about very dark and traumatizing experiences that are being unearthed. And Misbehavior, you know, although it has a campaigning edge to it, it definitely is a joyful film. And I think it's a celebratory film of women taking back their power. It's not, dark and traumatic. And I think we need that at a time like this. You know, there's just so much going on in the world to be worrying about that actually to remember and look back and get sustenance from previous generations and know that we're part of a legacy and a journey. And, you know, we're passing the baton onwards.
Would you say that that's something that you look for in a project, something that opens up a conversation and something that could hold a legacy, especially one that you think is really important today?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's always a bonus to me if a piece of work has an interesting conversation behind it, because I think that's what art is for, essentially. I think it's for us to look at ourselves, look at our culture and, get some perspective on where we've come from and where we're going. And I love the idea that, you know, potentially with something like Misbehavior or The Morning Show, you know, that the issues raised, you know, help people to see themselves in the work and see themselves in the story and either be uplifted or, you know, maybe it makes you laugh, maybe it makes you cry. But either way, it's a healing process and a way to feel, you know, like you're having a shared experience.
And what is it that you're working on next and what are you excited about doing in the future?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm actually working on a Disney Plus show by Marvel called Loki, which is a sort of spin-off limited series about the character Loki played by Tom Hiddleston. But I can't really tell you too much about my role because I'm sworn to secrecy.
But you're very excited.
I am very
about
excited.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was Gugu and Bata Raw. Interesting enough, do you remember that happened whenever we first started doing the podcast? We had no idea what the hell we were doing. And Dan did a podcast interview with someone and it didn't come out for whatever reason. So we had to go back in and loop his questions. And we kind of had to direct him to sound like conversational and stuff. And that was a fun
day. Hello, I'm Dan Jolin. Did you enjoy making the film? I love the way you said that.
For
remember
you,
back
what
when
is cinema?
We first started doing the podcast and we didn't know what we were doing, as if somehow that has changed in the intervening
years.
It's kind of changed. By the shit show at the Fuck Factory that is this particular broadcast.
It's kind of changed. We know what we're doing. We don't make any stupid... Bit of visual comedy there for a podcast.
Good. Yeah, works well. Oh, God.
We may never leave this building alive.
Almost certainly.
I think I've decided this is our lock-in. The lock-in of the Lamin flag. Time to talk about...
That's a Lamin flag?
The Lamin flag. It's
in Oxford?
No, Bottom. It's a reference from Bottom. I think it's the first episode. They get locked. No, it's from the live show. And Eddie goes, a lock-in at the Lamin flag!
Speaking of live shows, do you think it's a coincidence that Ireland have banned all public gathering a week after our live podcast in Dublin?
Well, lads, there's no way we're topping that.
Yeah, it's a direct response. Can you imagine if they had, like, if they'd banned all... We could have been stuck there forever, just live gigging.
Well, no, I would have just gone up to my hometown.
Yeah, I would have been fine.
I'd have just stayed there in the cinema doing endless podcasts.
Jesus, who let the Empire podcast ages into the country? Close all the borders. It's too late, they're gone. Ah, Jesus.
Well, thank God they weren't stuck here.
Infected us with their terrible opinions. Speaking of which, it's time to talk about this week's release.
There are still releases. There are still releases, plural.
At time of recording, yes. So let's start with Misbehavior, which is, well, I've already said what it is. Do you remember back at the beginning when we knew what we were doing? Helen, you've seen this movie.
I have seen this movie, yes. It is about the Miss 70, Miss World Contest 1970, but it's also about the women's liberation movement, which was active at the time, was really being born at the time, which saw this opportunity to kind of make some noise, essentially. But they had nothing against the beauty queens themselves. They wanted to make it clear it was the principle of this competition, this kind of parading of women who at the time, by the way, were literally weighed and measured, and their weight and measurements were made public as a part of the competition. So it'd be like Miss Grenada 34 25 36 is here from, and you know, and you're just like, oh wow, that's not cool.
That was going on a long time after 1970.
It was a very, very long time, but it's a really interesting way of approaching the story. It just means that there are a lot of moving parts to this. And if you've seen the poster for this, you may be expecting a knockabout comedy. Mm-hmm. And it is not, actually. It's sometimes very funny, but more often it is more of a drama, and it's kind of an ensemble piece. So you've got Keira Knightley's Sally Alexander. These are all based on real people. Keira Knightley's Sally Alexander, who's a history student and one of the sort of activists in this new women's liberation movement. Jesse Buckley, who plays Joe Robinson, who's a much more kind of radical, kind of anarchist member of the movement.
But not Joe Robinson of the Vanity Fair podcast.
Not the one of Vanity Fair, but I look forward to hearing her reaction to this one. Yeah. You've also got Gugu Mbatha-Raw, we've discussed, as Miss Grenada, who's one of the contestants. Larice Harrison, who's kind of a fairly newcomer as the representative of Africa South. If you're wondering where South is, it's because the apartheid campaigners objected to there only being a white Miss South Africa. And so they sent a second contestant, and that was her. And she's a wonderful, wonderful character. So there's all these people. You've also got Greg Kinnear as Bob Hope, who's coming in to sort of do a bit of a gig during the show. There's a lot of different people represented here. So sometimes it's a little unfocused as a result of that.
Yeah, I think so.
But it does give you a bit more kind of context, I guess, and a more texture, I suppose, to the story, which I think is what the director, Philippa Lowthorpe, was going for. She, by the way, is the person who made Three Girls, which is an absolutely fantastic piece of TV, and she's done things like The Crown. She launched Call the Midwife. So, you know, she kind of knows what she's doing, but it does sometimes, I think, feel a little bit more, it has more of that TV texture, where you have more time to get into all of this stuff.
It's because you have a feeling, well, I had a feeling while watching it that, look, first of all, it's immensely likeable, I think. It's a very watchable film. It's a fascinating, true story.
So, yeah.
It's a lot of fun, and it is provocative in its own way, but I think the problem is that you can feel the screenwriting happening as you're watching it. There are plot contrivances coming in quite blatantly, and I think generally it feels like quite a pedestrian film about revolutionary people. You know, this was a time of great change and all of that, and what's going on in the story is quite wild, but the film itself isn't. I don't think the way the film is made is kind of true to the spirit of what's going on screen, if that makes sense.
Yep, I agree with both of you.
But really good performances all around, I think.
Yeah, really good.
Gugu is really great in it.
And Knightley, actually.
I feel that because it starts with the Keira Knightley character, and she's your anchor throughout the film, even though it's an ensemble. And I felt that Gugu's character got a little bit lost in the shuffle a little bit, which is interesting given how significant she was to that year. Don't want to give things away, but you can look it up on Wikipedia.
Well, it's almost like there's two different stories going on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It feels like. And Gugu's great in it. And there's a scene, I don't want to spoil it, obviously, but there's a scene involving her towards the end, which has got some real fire to it.
Yeah, really good scene.
And you feel like the film could have done with more of that.
Mm. I think she's being very true to the character, though, because I actually hosted a Q&A and met the real Jennifer Houston this week. And she is extraordinarily composed. She's very elegant, obviously, and super beautiful. But just very composed, very calm, very internal. And I think that was very much part of her, you know, essentially her winning. I don't think it was a strategy. I think it's who she is. But I think it was part of the reason she won was because she is very much sort of serene that way.
Yeah.
So I think it's. I mean, Gugu does give her some texture, but it's not a character who is as fiery as the women's rights activists outside.
You know?
But for example, I thought Bob Hope was a bit, you know, it could have been just a nice little cameo, but instead he has. And Greg Kinnear is fine.
Yeah.
But he has a fairly major role in the movie. And
I asked about that, and I think it's to do with the fact that he represents that sort of, you know, absolutely thoughtless sexism that was going on at the time. You know, he's not a bad guy.
No.
But he was absolutely a womanizer. He absolutely cheated on his wife throughout their, I think, 60-year marriage. And he just very casually, absolutely matter-of-factly made sexist jokes all the time and was beloved for it, you know. So I think it's, I think maybe that's kind of what he's representing in a way, that no one else in the script does.
You can probably hear from our opinions that we liked the film, we didn't love it, and that is reflected in the star rating. 3 stars then for Misbehaviour, which is, of course, as we say in the podcast every single week, is a recommendation. Next up, Alex, I know you've seen this one, The Hunt.
Yes.
Now, this is the controversial one. This was effectively not banned in the States, but they took it from the release schedules. They plucked it from the release schedules for a little bit.
I think Trump tweeted negatively about it without having seen it, of course. I think, am I wrong? I think there was a shooting around the time. I think
there was,
I get the impression that was the main reason they cancelled it. So it's out now. The film itself, I don't think, is as controversial as people might think. It's being marketed as the film everybody's talking about. I don't know if everybody was talking about it, but that's what they're saying. So it opens up like a bit of a Twilight Zone episode. It gets very gory very quickly, and we find ourselves in the middle of the woods, people waking up gagged and bound, and it's a place called the Manor, and they're sort of let loose and find themselves being hunted down and shot. It gets very grisly, very gory, very quickly. In the first 15 minutes, all sorts of very, very grisly things happen to these people. And then we find out that what's happening is there are a bunch of liberal elites running this game and shooting people. So it's a play on, you know, these human hunting films that have been going on since The Most Dangerous Game, which was about 1920s.
Yeah,
And you've had, obviously, Battle Royale and The Hunger Games. And this one is co-written, I think, conceived by Damon Lindelof, who's done lately? The Leftovers and The Watchmen. And this is him, I think, having a go at the discourse. He left Twitter a few years ago. I don't know, would you say he was hounded off it?
Yeah, he was. He's still thriving on Instagram, but yes, he couldn't tweet without people calling him a dickhead, which is ridiculous because he's an incredibly talented guy. But just, you can change your settings, Damon, so you don't see those things.
Yeah.
You know, but
at first sight, this looks like a film in which liberals are gunning down Trumpites, or it maybe even Democrats versus Republicans. But it is that, but again, it's not that simple. And if anything, the film is more scathing about the liberal elites and all the virtual signaling that this film attributes them with, and the hysteria that's just been built up around these two sides, and how the whole sort of cultures have evolved or devolved into an us versus them bit of tribalism. And it's kind of a grindhouse film in satire clothing. It's not supposed to be taken that seriously, I think. I thought it was very funny. I thought it was a lot of fun. It's directed by Craig Zobel, and it's directed very well. I think there are some great action set pieces in it. But it is a funny thing. A lot of people have sort of taken umbrage with this film and said, it's not as smart as it thinks it is, and what's it trying to do, and what's it trying to say. But I think it's just having fun with the state that we're all in.
Mm. So we gave this 2 stars. You sound a little bit more up.
I enjoyed it. I would give it at least a 3, maybe 4, just because I thought it was done with a lot of style, a lot of fun, and it made me laugh.
Bloody hell. Wow.
There's some great action in it as well. There's some really, really great set pieces.
And it's 90 minutes long, and I cannot recommend enough a film that is 90 minutes long.
Yeah,
I had a toss-up between this and Bloodshot yesterday. I had to go and see one of them so I could talk about it in this week's podcast, and I chose Bloodshot because I had the sense that no one else would have seen Bloodshot, and I felt that Finn needed to be represented. But I do very much want to see The Hunt, which opened on Wednesday and is now out in kinemas. So 2 stars in for The Hunt, which brings us neatly on indeed to Bloodshot, which is the latest attempt by Vin Diesel to start a franchise that isn't Riddick related or indeed Fast and Furious related. And this one is based on a comic book that I didn't particularly know, or in fact know at all. And it is a Valiant Comics story, and it is an attempt to start a shared cinematic universe. But I think here is where that ends. It's interesting because Vin Diesel in this movie plays a soldier who is killed at the beginning of the film, and he is brought back to life using incredible nanotechnology by Guy Pearce's possibly
Killian?
Shady scientist.
Right.
Possibly shady scientist. And he is surrounded by 3 other superhuman, augmented, techie type people. One played by Isaac Gonzalez from Baby Driver.
Oh, yeah.
and he is basically a killing machine who cannot be killed. So he has these nanobites and these nanobots inside him, which means he can access the World Wide Web at any point. And rather than looking at porn, what he decides to do instead is hunt down the person who killed his wife.
Oh.
Who is played, in this case, the person who killed his wife, not his wife, by Toby Kebbell.
Ooh.
This is the movie
is he an ape or
no? He's playing. He has himself, Toby Kebbell. Okay. Well, not as himself. No, he didn't. Toby Kebbell didn't kill Vin Diesel's wife. Sure. That'd be terrible. But this is probably my tweet yesterday. One day Hollywood will figure out what to do with Toby Kebbell, who is a fantastic talent trapped in a leading man's body, and they just don't seem to know what to do with him. Mm. He keeps getting these fifth, sixth, seventh banana roles, sometimes comic relief roles. It's really good at the mocap stuff as well, as evidenced in Kong and the first Planet of the Apes movie as well. But he's really good, you guys. Give him the hero roles in these things.
What was that Guy Ritchie film he was in? He was very good in
Rock and Roller.
He was very good in that.
He's a really good actor. Fantastic in Dead Man's Shoes.
Destroyer. I literally took about half an hour before I recognised him.
Didn't know it was him.
No. Really, really great.
Wasn't he in one of those great Black Mirror episodes many years ago?
He probably was.
The Entire History of You, was that him? I think so.
I know he's in Servant as well, which I haven't seen yet, which is the M. Night Shyamalan Apple TV show. Yeah, but he's great, but he's not the star of this movie, and perhaps this movie might have succeeded better or succeeded at all if it had had someone who could emote in the lead role. Because Finn is kind of phoning it in this one. And listen, I like my Finn. I think he's great in the right circumstances, but this isn't really the role. It's not really a grabber of a role. Mm. And it's one of those movies that I went in expecting an absolute one-star shocker because it wasn't being screened to press, which is why I had to go and pay to see it yesterday on the day it opened. That's usually, that usually sets the alarm bells ringing. Also, it looked terrible and everything we knew about it was like, oh, this could be bad. This could be just like a cheap sci-fi knockoff. It's actually quite interesting. And as I watched the film and I was like, oh, this is a bit clumsy. That scene's not working because that's just bad screenwriting. And then they pulled the rug out from under me. There's a couple of reveals in this movie that are actually quite clever. And they deserve to be better directed, I think. And the screenwriters in this are Jeff Wadlow and Eric Heiserer, who wrote Arrival. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine Eric Heiserer came on and rewrote Jeff Wadlow's script and added in lots of cool Black Mirror-y type stuff, you know, messing with reality. But it's also got real clunkers of dreams. Like Finn at one point goes,
how can you have nightmares when I don't even have memories?
Give me my honey.
I want my money, honey. I'm in the mummy.
Oh my God, there's a killer today. How does he do that voice without just coughing all the time?
I think it comes naturally to him. Sorry, I've just stepped out. I've come back into the room now. I've been away.
You come in just the right time, taught by Finn Diesel.
Have you ever read any of the
I didn't know it. Comics. I didn't know it at all.
Yeah, he's quite a sort of well-known character within the Valiant comic line.
Great.
Harbinger's, I think, another one in there. I don't read Valiant comics. He's got a following.
This will be of real consolation to the four people who read those comic books. very, very
exciting. Exo Man of War is another Valiant one, I think.
Okay. Yeah. I should check him out. But this movie's not making me race to check him out. But there's some interesting ideas in this. The performances aren't terrible, Finn aside. But it just doesn't really come together and the action scenes are not very well directed. You can't really tell what's going on, which is a shame because he's a superhuman killing machine who cannot be killed and you'd expect that would lead to some really, really cool action scenes.
He's the
cop. It doesn't.
He can't be stopped.
He can't. He's the boss that could not slow down.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a shame. It is a bit of a shame. Oh. But
I really want to see it regardless. It's very much my jam.
It very much is. I will give a shout out to Lamorne Morris, who people might know from New Girl. And he's in this movie playing a hacker and a British hacker at that. And his accent, spot on. Spot on. He's really, really funny in this movie.
Is he, in fact, from Liverpool? And is he the ninth member of the Beatles?
Member of the Beatles? No.
Are we only up to nine? I thought we were well above that.
He's the 27th member of the Beatles. So go and see him. Go and see the movie for him. Go and see it for maybe some decent effects stuff. Go see him for Toby Kebbell.
All right, but two stars.
Two stars.
Okay.
Two stars in for Bloodshot, and we're going to round out the week on a high with Cam with Horses, which is the movie. If you listened to last week's show, we had Niamh Algar and the film's director Nick Rowland on as part of our incredible cabal of guests.
Yeah.
And Hell's Bells. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, I really like this. So this is set on the west coast of Ireland, and there's a former boxer who's called, generally known as Arm. His name is actually like Armstrong. But anyway, he's played by Cosmo Jarvis from Lady Macbeth. And he has basically started working as a thug for a crime family called the Deavers, who he's most associated with their kind of younger generation, Dimfna, which is a very Irish name, you just don't get anywhere else, who's played by Barry Keoghan. So anyway, Arm has an ex-girlfriend who's played by Niamh Elgar. She's great. And a young son who has autism. And he's kind of a little bit torn, I think, now between his kind of two families, between these criminals who have taken him in and made him one of their team, and then also his kind of responsibilities to his son, Jack. And Niamh's trying to get Jack into a special school and, you know, get him the kind of support that he needs to kind of develop. And it's just a really interesting character piece, because you've got him torn between these two worlds. You've got this guy who clearly needed the same kind of help that his son now needs at one point in his past and didn't get it, and is kind of aware that his life has gone a different way because of that. He's a guy who's very good at violence, but we're told in the opening seconds of the film doesn't actually enjoy it. That's what he does. Same. It's not personal, you know. Yeah. And I think it's just a fantastic, fantastic character study of him. I'm really intrigued because a few people have said, oh, you know, it's very kind of predictable at the ending. And one of the reasons I really liked this was I didn't think it was predictable at all what happens at the end of this film. I think it kind of skews away a couple of times from the genre beats that you expect it to hit. Mm-hmm. There are obviously some kind of cram drama stuff in there, but not all the ones that you think it's going to go for. And I think that was really, really strong and just fantastic performances. And I do think that, you know, now he's not here, I can say this, but Nick Rowland, I think, is a really strong director. This is his this is his first feature.
Yeah.
And I think that as a first feature, this is incredible stuff. And I think it presages really, really well for his future. Michael Fassbender produced it, and I think saw something in him that has clearly paid off. But beautiful, obviously, scenery, because it's set in the west of Ireland and there isn't really any other kind there. But I think it's really worth a look. It's kind of a little bit McDonough-y, maybe not quite as funny as that, but it has a bit of the McDonough-iness about it.
Yeah, except, well, it's not so comical.
It's not as funny. No, there are moments of funniness in it.
Yeah.
Needles, the Belfast guy, is pretty funny.
The thing I liked most about it was that cast. I mean, all three, Cosmo, Barry and Niamh are incredible in it. They are also completely authentic, and there's a real electricity with all of them separately and together. There's a real danger about those guys in it. Cosmo Jarvis has, there's something of a wrongness about him, as there was in, I think he was in one episode of Peaky Blinders, and he was kind of terrifying in it. And there's some, he's kind of, and anything could happen with him in this film. He could explode any minute, and he's trying not to. He's containing it, but you feel like, you know, he's in his battle with himself. And in terms of the slice of life part of this film, just watching these people live and, you know, struggle, I thought it was incredible. I think if anything, it goes off the rails a little bit, just because I think it starts off with the feel that you're hanging out with all these people and you're just watching what they do. And then it does get a bit heavy on the plot. Yeah, yeah, a little bit. But they're amazing people to watch, and it is beautiful.
Yeah.
3 stars.
I would have gone higher.
Okay. So, sounds good. I didn't see it last week, sadly. I was flying blind. Thank God I had Helen there to take the controls and stick the landing. No, wait, that's a gymnastic reference. But yes, 3 stars. 3 stars then for Cam with Horses. Do check it out if you feel like you want to go to the cinema this weekend.
Yes, and you know, there are worse places you could be. As long as they're still open.
Yes. As long as it's still open.
Be careful who's sitting behind you.
Yes. And don't go, of course, if you're sick. In all seriousness, don't go if you're sick. If you feel sick in any way, shape, or form, stay home, stay hydrated, stay healthy, and you know.
Stay woke.
This sounds like a Jerry Springer outro.
Well, no, I'm just trying to make sure that people don't fucking die. It's, you know, I'm just trying to do my bit.
Yes, yes. Carry on, Chris. Carry on.
This is inspirational.
It is. It is. This is your St. Crispin's Day.
Yes, it really is.
Today we celebrate.
We happy few.
We band of buggered.
Yeah. Anyway.
We aim to misbehave.
On that note.
Now we're just mixing up Joss Whedon references.
Oh my God. On that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week, fingers crossed, for more film-related fun. Assuming, of course, there are any films to be released. We shall see what happens when we will be joined on the Empire Podcast by a guest I've already spoken to. And we did shake hands.
No.
So if he has it, then I have it. And if I had it, then he has it.
Yes, that's
it is, of course, the star of Radioactive, Sam Riley. Sam Riley on the Empire Podcast. Very exciting. Anyway, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. It is goodbye, of course, from James Dyer.
Goodbye.
Exhausted after having contributed so much to the review section.
Yeah. So much so I just wandered out of the room to do other things.
He just merrily walked out, came back in again. Haven't seen any of these films.
I get used to that. We're not going to be seeing anything in future. at least my part in this podcast won't really change.
We're really selling the upcoming episodes of this podcast. Our guests are probably dead. The films are probably not released.
And there'll be no news.
There's no news to talk about. Yeah. Delighted to be joined, of course, by Alex Godfrey. Goodbye for him.
I'm going home to self-isolate until the morning when I will see you again.
Yes, indeed. And of course, it is goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye for me. I'm off to think about more songs where Dracula could have joined the Beatles. For example, A Hard Day's Bite. I've been working like a bat.
That's very good.
Thanks for listening. See you next week. Maybe. Bye.
Oh, God.